Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
Over the last couple of decades, a number of voices have been arguing that somehow there's something deeply wrong, something morally wrong, with an exclusivist, with exclusivist versions of Christianity. And many have made the arguments that we should be inclusivist, or that we should be pluralist. We should be, or we could be many things, but we shouldn't be exclusivist. In this talk, I'm going to look at two people who have been arguing that there's something wrong with exclusivism. First, John Hick, and another somewhat elderly theologian who's still widely influential, Wilfred Campbell Smith. He has been arguing that there is something deeply morally puzzling about being exclusivist. So, what I'll try to get clear about is, what is it to be an exclusivist, and what is it to be a Christian exclusivist? Which, you know, what sort of properties do you need to have in order for you to qualify as an exclusivist? And next, I'm going to talk about the topic. Well, suppose we can come up with a good idea of what it is to be an exclusivist. Is it really the case that there's something morally objectionable to being such a person, or to being such a Christian, or to being such a believer? So I will argue that there is nothing inherently morally implausible or puzzling or off-putting in being an exclusivist. Of course, I do grant that Christians can display all sorts of bad moral properties. They can be look down on other people. They can engage in all the vices that the Bible tells us about. Still, I don't think there's anything morally objectionable to being a Christian exclusivist. As a matter of fact, I don't think there's an alternative to being an exclusivist of sorts. That'll be my line. So, I'll follow the handout fairly closely. So, if I talk about exclusivism and talk about Christian exclusivism, what I mean is something like this. It's a thesis. I think about exclusivism as a claim, as a thesis. It's the thesis that if Jesus is the only way to God is true, if this claim is true, then the denial of that claim must be false. That's just a matter of elementary logic. Now, it's claimed that exclusivism constitutes a moral problem. It's claimed that Christians are arrogant or otherwise morally reprehensible when they believe that Jesus is the only way to God and leave all other things connected with this particular claim, let's say all those things that are listed in the Creed or in the Apostles' Creed, Christians are supposed to be arrogant or morally objectionable in case they believe these things and believes that the denial of these things are false. One person who argues for that is John Hick. John Hick, I do think that personally he was a very friendly man, and he had at least one extraordinary clever PhD student whom we all, I think, admire as one of the best apologists of our age. Hick says in one of his works, "The ultimate divine reality is infinite, and as such transcends the grasp of the human mind. God is infinite. He is not a thing, not a part of the universe, existing alongside other things, nor is he a being falling under a certain kind, and therefore he cannot be defined or encompassed by human thought. We cannot draw boundaries around his nature and say he is this and no more." One way he motivates this view is by making a reference to the famous parable of Buddha, who talks about various people being in contact with an elephant. One touches the trunk of the elephant, one touches the leg, other touches the tail of the elephant, and they all give different descriptions of what it is for something to be an elephant. So an elephant is that's a sturdy, strong, big thing. Another say, well, it's a jolly it's a tail that's making these nice gentle movements and the like. Well, these people don't understand, says Buddha, that they are talking about different parts of the same thing. Now, Hick takes a different conclusion from that story, from that parable. His conclusion is that no statement about God is really true, because none of our concepts applies to God. So if you take the concept of being the creator of the heavens and the earth, then that's a concept that we have, and Hick claims that concept doesn't apply to God. Or if we have the concept of being loving, that's a concept that we have, and Hick claims that concept doesn't apply to God. Being hateful is a concept that we have, it doesn't apply to God. Mention any concept or think about any concept, and Hick claims it doesn't apply to God. Now, what is it for a concept to apply to something? When does a concept apply to something? Well, here's an elementary way to think about concepts. To have a concept means to be able to grasp a property. So if I have the concept of red, then I'm able to apply the concept of red in appropriate circumstances. So if I'm going to test you on your ability to wield the concept of red and you apply it to blue and yellow things, then I can conclude from that there's something wrong with your grasp of the property of red. You don't work in the correct ways with the concept of red. So what is it for a concept to apply to something? Well, for a concept to apply to something is to say of a certain thing that it possesses a particular property. Right? So if the concept of red, or let's say if the concept of blue applies to my jacket, then that means that my jacket has the property of being blue, or has the property of blueness. Now, if none of our concepts applies to God, then God has no properties that we have concepts of. Right? If none of our concepts applies to God, then God doesn't have any property that we have concepts of. So let's think for a moment about existence. There's a philosophical discussion about whether existence is a property or not. Let's, for the sake of this meeting, think that existence is a property. Well, we grasp the property of existence, right? So we think there is such a country as the Netherlands. The Netherlands exists. Right, there is a country and it has this particular property of existence. Well, if none of our concepts applies to God, then neither does the property of existence apply to God, which means that God doesn't exist. Another obvious property that we will ascribe to anything that exists at all is the property of self-identity. So I'm René van Woudenberg. I'm identical to myself. You know, I couldn't have been identical to my wife or to any of my books or to my guitar. As Joseph Butler, the important British philosopher of the 17th century, said, everything is what it is and not something else. So the property of self-identity, well, that's a property a thing could not possibly lack. Still, Hick says, none of the concepts that we have is such that it applies to God. We have the concept of self-identity. Well, since, or if none of our concepts apply to God, then the concept of self-identity doesn't apply to God, which means that God doesn't have the property of self-identity. Now, this way of thinking, just in order to push pluralism or inclusivist views, has very strange consequences when you come to think about it. One strange consequence is this: has at least one property that is a concept that we have, right? I have, the concept has at least one property is applicable to myself, right? For instance, I'm a man, and also I'm a Dutch person, I'm married, I have children, I teach philosophy and the like. Those are properties that I have. So the concept has at least one property is applicable to myself. And it's applicable to all of you. But if none of our concepts applies to God, then it's not true that God has at least one property, which means that God has no property. Right? If none of our concepts applies to God, then that concept doesn't apply to God either, which means that God has no properties. But also, has no properties, doesn't apply to God either, which means that God has properties. So you get very contradictory implications when you follow this line of thought. Now, Hicks' argument, when you spell it out somewhat more clearly, is basically this. He has one premise and one conclusion. The premise is God is ultimate. And what's supposed to follow from that is that none of our concepts applies to God. None of our concepts apply to God. However, the premise, God is ultimate, whatever that property or whatever that may be, whatever it may mean that God is ultimate, it surely ascribes a certain property to God. If you say that God is ultimate, then you say there is a being, there is God, and it has the property of ultimateness. Which means that the argument cannot be coherently proposed. Moreover, the conclusion, none of our concepts apply to God, is self-referentially incoherent. For what this conclusion says is, or if what this conclusion says is true, then it must be false. For as follows, if none of our concepts applies to God, then the concept none of our concepts applies to God must apply to God, which is just to say that the conclusion is false. So if you go down this route of John Hick, then you wind up in a very unstable position. You end up saying things that are massively incoherent. And all the time, Hick is assuming that if you're an exclusivist and if you think that any of these Christian beliefs is true, that there's something morally reprehensible about you. There's something morally wicked or wrong about you when you hold these particular beliefs. He's just assuming that. And in order to evade that, he is proposing his pluralist views of religion. Well, this is what I think is very, very very problematic. Let me therefore move on to Cantwell Smith. He, in certain ways, he's a bit more elaborate. I start out with a quote that I put on the handout. He says, "Except at the cost of insensitivity or delinquency, it is morally not possible actually to go out into the world and say to devout intelligent human beings, we believe that we know God, and we are right. You believe that you know God, and you are totally wrong." He says this is morally entirely substandard. It's insensitive. It's a form of delinquency even. Now, the objection is also often stated in terms of arrogance or suppression. And the idea is that when I'm a Christian, and I believe the things that the creed helps me say, and I also believe that the denials of what the creed says are false, that I am thereby morally reprehensible. I do something that's really morally bad or something that's morally wicked. I'm repressing other people. Well, in my department there are philosophers who have completely different views than I have. I know they are materialists. And they will believe that anything that's incompatible with materialism is false. Well, I felt myself suppressed by them or repressed by them or felt beleaguered by them. We were having a philosophical discussion, and the simple fact that what he or she says is incompatible with what I believe or what I think is clearly insufficient for meriting a moral objection to what that other person is saying or doing, or it doesn't shade negatively on the character of the person. Let's go a bit deeper into this. Now, first note that the claim of Christian exclusivism is distinct from other claims that might easily be taken for it, such as that Christians are better persons than non-Christians. Well, I hope that generally speaking, Christians are better persons than non-Christians, but being a Christian exclusivist isn't the claim Christians are better persons than non-Christians. Nor is it the claim that Christianity has only brought peace and happiness in the world, or that Christians have only brought peace and happiness in the world. The claim of Christian exclusivism just isn't that claim. Or in the 19th century German intellectual environment, there were these claims to the effect that Christianity is absolute. That was a historical thesis with a lot of philosophical baggage or luggage behind it. German idealism was behind it. Ernst Troeltsch was very critical of that thesis. But whatever the claim that Christianity is absolute might mean, it just isn't the claim that I've had put first on the handout. Nor is it the claim that the Christian Church has the exclusive claim to truth. Nor is the claim that Christians know the whole truth and non-Christians know nothing of it. That's not the claim of Christian exclusivism. Christian exclusivism is not a claim about Christians, nor about Christianity, nor about the Christian Church, but about Christ. It's the claim that Christ is God's ultimate revelation, and that whatever claims to revelation there are should be normed by the norm that is Christ himself. Now, is Christian exclusivism, or is a person who is a Christian exclusivist, arrogant and suppressive? Aren't these two vices the inevitable concomitants of what Christians believe? I think not. More must be said, though, in order to have a firm grip of what it means to be an exclusivist. So if a person is to be an exclusivist with respect to any belief, or with respect to belief in any proposition that I just refer to as P, or P might be Christ is the way to God, or the exclusive way to God, or it might be historical materialism is true, or naturalism is true, or whatever, any claim you can think of. If a person is to be an exclusivist with respect to a particular claim or belief in a proposition, then the following conditions need to be satisfied. Three conditions, I should think. First, you should believe that that proposition or what you believe is true, and that what contradicts P or what contradicts that proposition is false. That's minimal. That's what you should do. Or that's at least a necessary condition for qualifying as an exclusivist. But of course, that's insufficient. More should be the case. Suppose that I'm really interested in working in mathematics, and I'm talking to some high school kids, and I'm telling them I believe that the square root of two, the square root of 2 is not a rational number, and I'm able to prove that. Well, and the high school kid says, "Come on, I don't believe that." Well, am I, when I'm just pushing on and maintaining my point of view or maintaining my thesis, am I thereby an exclusivist, and am I thereby meriting some moral, or am I contracting some moral objection by that very token? Well, I don't think so. The reason is that I can easily prove that that mathematical theorem. It seems that if you can prove a particular thing, and you can, and you know that there are other people who don't know about the proof, then when you continue believing the conclusions of your proof, well, nothing irregular is going on. No moral objections can be launched or can be put at you. So there is this element that what you believe should be, in a way, beyond proof. You may have interesting arguments for it, good arguments, but if the thing can be proved, then you cannot qualify as an exclusivist. And a further thing that needs to be the case if you are to qualify as an exclusivist, and it is, you really have to be aware of other people who disagree with what you believe. So my grandmother, she lived in a rural village. She was raised in a Christian community, and she was a devout person. She didn't know about Muslims, she didn't know about Islam, she didn't know about Buddhism, materialism, naturalism, nothing of the sort. Was she an exclusivist of a very vicious sort because she carried on believing what she did believe? Oh, that strains credulity, right? So if you're living in a homogeneous community, then it's very hard to be an exclusivist. And certainly it's very hard to be an exclusivist and to merit some, or to contract or to attract some moral objections towards what you believe in. Now let's, just for the sake of argument, assume that these conditions for being an exclusivist obtain in the case of Christianity or of Christian belief. So when we believe that Christ is the only way to God, let's then suppose that we believe this to be true, and we believe the denial of it to be false. We don't think this can be proved in the way that a number of mathematical theorems can be proved. And also we are fully aware of the fact that there are others, religious believers, other religious believers, but also non-religious believers, who disagree with us. So let's suppose that these three conditions for being an exclusivist hold for Christians who believe that Christ is the only way to God. Now suppose, or if you accuse such a Christian, or if such a Christian is accused if you accuse an exclusivist, a Christian exclusivist, that he is arrogant simply by fulfilling these three conditions, well, then you can only say that to that Christian by being an exclusivist yourself in another area. So here's an image that I like. If a Christian is accused of being an exclusivist and is therefore said to be arrogant, the person saying this is handing out a tar baby to someone else. So if I hand out a tar baby to you, a tar baby, that's a baby that's put on, it's tar put over the baby, so it's a een teerpop. So the idea is there's something that has a baby-like shape, And tar is poured all over over the thing. No? Or something that's something that really sticks to your fingers. What is
something? You make asphalt. Right?
I make
asphalt. Yeah.
Asphalt, but then. But then, before it actually is, how do you call it? Before it's dry. So when you eat pancakes, what sort of syrup you put on it? Well, it sticks to your finger. Right when you put your hand on the pancake, on the syrup, that's really bad. I suppose there's a puppet that you have, and you put the syrup all over it. Well, in order to hand over that tar baby or that syrup baptized baby to another person, you have to take it into your own hands, and so you get dirty hands yourself. And the traditional idea behind this tar baby is it's sort of a joke. You try to mislead another person by seducing that person to take up that thing and thereby smearing or getting dirty hands. But the point is, you can't play the trick on that other person only by getting dirty hands yourself. Well, I thought it was a good point for illustrative purposes, but it's entirely missing the point, I fear. All right, so suppose now that I believe the things that the creed helped me say. I profess those things that the creed says. And now I'm accused of being arrogant by that very token. I suppose I feel bothered by this. I feel bothered by being called arrogant or being suppressed, right? That's not a nice predicament to be in or said that you have that sort of properties. Now, what are my options? Well, my options are these. I can continue believing what the creed says. I can carry on believing these things. I can become an agnostic, which means I can believe, I can start, or here's my attitude, I neither believe nor disbelieve the creed. I just shore up my verdict on its content. And finally, I might start believing the denials of the creed. I think these are my options. Now, suppose if I carry on, if I take the first option, then of course I haven't evaded the problem. Then if I was an exclusivist and therefore I was a morally objectionable person, then I will still continue to be an exclusivist and will continue to be a morally objectionable person. Now, if I take option three, if I start believing the denials of the creed, well, then I still know there are very many people who disbelieve my new formed belief. I now no longer believe that Christ is the only way to God, but there are all these Christians who believe the denials of what I now believe. And I'm aware of them. I'm aware of their existence. And furthermore, I know that I can't prove my new point, that Christ is not the only way to God. I still cannot prove that point. So, the three conditions that have to be satisfied for one to be an exclusivist still hold for my new formed position. And if being an exclusivist is sufficient for being arrogant, or is sufficient for being suppressive, well then this third option isn't going to help me. I'm still in exclusivist predicament, and I'm still, if these people are correct, I'm still such that I'm a bad person. I do things that are morally unwise, morally improper. Now, you might think that becoming an agnostic might help, but it doesn't really help. Because when I become an agnostic, if I take the second option, then I neither believe that Christ is the only way to God, nor disbelieve that Christ is the only way to God. But still, I'm disagreeing both with Christians, and with all those non-Christian theists around the world. So I'm still saying, well, compared to these groups of people, my attitude is morally superior. So although for the second option, the case is somewhat different, it's still the case that I can only take a position by, in effect, condemning both Christians and non-Christian theists alike. So, in a way, I'm still an exclusivist. My position hasn't become better. So, if none of these options will prevent my being arrogant, then it seems there is no alternative to being an exclusivist. Or, actually, what I should say is, there is no alternative to being an exclusivist, whatever your position is. And if exclusivism as such is morally reprehensible, then we should all be called morally reprehensible persons by the token. But it's very unclear whether there's anything morally wrong with or whether exclusivism merits this verdict of arrogance. So here is an analogy that I like to work with. So the analogy aims to make it clear that there simply is no internal connection between exclusivism and arrogance. Sure, exclusivist people may be arrogant, they may not be arrogant. My point here is there's no internal connection between the two. Suppose I can make a fortune by telling a small lie about a colleague of mine. But after reflection, I conclude that this would be wrong to do. So I believe now that it's wrong, that it would be wrong to tell that lie. But none of the people I speak about this agree with me. They all think that it isn't wrong. They think, sure, you should have told the little lie about the colleague. So many goodies would follow from it, whereas the person itself wouldn't be too bad off because of your lie about that person. Well, I cannot convince them of their wrongness, nor can I convince them of their rightness. Well, in this case, the three conditions for being an exclusivist are satisfied, both on my part as on the part of my colleagues, or the friends that I discussed this matter with. But it would be utterly wrong, I should think, that from the very fact that I can convince my friends that what I did was right, I can't conclude from that, and therefore I'm arrogant. It seems foolish. It seems crazy. So what I've been trying to say is that if you take the John Hick position, if you think there is a problem with exclusivism, and therefore we should go for pluralism, and we go down the John Hick line by saying none of our concepts is such that it applies to God, then you wind up in a pit of incoherency. When you go down the Wilfred Cantwell Smith line, and you say that exclusivism is in its very nature an arrogant position, something that's morally reprehensible, then my response to that is, you can only say such a thing provided you are an exclusivist of sorts yourself, because the exclusivist position seems just to be the human predicament that we cannot escape and that no one can escape. Thank you so much.